My sobriety date is July 22nd, 2006. I have a sponsor. I sponsor ladies. My home group is Parkview in Richmond. We meet on Tuesdays at 8 o'clock. It's an open speaker meeting. It's one of the oldest meetings in Richmond that was just about to die, and a number of us went over there and joined that group, and we've tried to bring some new life back into it in prayer, and it's been interesting. It's not what I got sober over in Jaywalkers. I know some of you guys are familiar with that group, and it's very strong group, solution-oriented, great message, and it's been good transition, I guess, to go to this home group and see how God can slowly bring some miracles around. So, as usual, I'm real nervous. You know, I try so hard to give this to God. I haven't been thinking for the last 2 days, what am I going to say? Maybe just a flash, and then I'll pray that away. I was one of those people that I just about was dead when I came in here almost 6 years ago. And so my story is so long, I never know exactly what God will bring out when I give my talk. But and it's really interesting, too, because I was speaking with someone this morning on the phone who pointed out that little passage on page 29 about how we, or the stories in the book, the folks have, you know, relayed how they developed a relationship with God. And I never paid attention to that, but that is just about what my story is about. I tried all of my life to, you know, since I was a kid, baptized at 5 and going into church, being in the choir, trying to run the show and, you know, do everything I could to be good and read the Bible. I never could, you know, develop that relationship with God or have that kind of spiritual life that I never really knew anything about until I came in here and surrendered my life and went through these steps. So it was interesting to hear that you guys brought that passage up. That's 3 times today I've heard that. So I guess, you know, in addition to, you know, as my story will describe how, you know, God has come into my life and turned it completely around in almost the last 6 years. But it's also, I'm supposed to let you know what, you know, what it was like and what happened and maybe a bit about what it's like today in a general way. I want to say from the outset that I am so humbly grateful that, you know, God put people and things in my life that brought me to these rooms on my knees, and, you know, about 6 years ago. I'm close to 6 years sober, but I was coming in the rooms for 6 months before God removed that desire to drink, you know, and it was only when I was willing to take the actions that was done. But I was close to death. I'd been in AA and knew I was an alcoholic since my early 20s and just thought it looked like a death sentence to me to have to come to these meetings. And I figured if I worked and paid my bills, I was going to have me some fun in this life. And I got to say, I did have some good times, but as time went on, they became less and less, and it became more and more bizarre. To the end, I wouldn't even drink in public because I knew that, I mean, I am that kind of bottom, hopeless alcoholic, you know, that once I take a drink, we're on, and I'm not going to stop until, I black out, and I don't know what I've done, things completely out of my character. And those incidents grew more and more frequent, you know, towards the end of my drinking. It was very sick. I was at the jumping off place. You know, and I came in these rooms and refused to get a sponsor. I couldn't see anybody in here who qualified to tell me what to do. And sick as I was, and one got me. And she was a big book sponsor, and she took me through the steps. And, you know, within 2 weeks of having that sponsor, God lifted that desire to drink. And this has been, you know, an interesting journey and in some ways an uphill battle to recreate and reconstruct the life of the mess that I made. But I am so humbly grateful. You're looking at somebody who I may be able to touch on this, tried absolutely everything out there to try to stop drinking, church, all these different you know, Rational Recovery, the Jeffrey the Fry guy that wrote the Jim Fry that wrote Million Little Pieces, and tried to use his little theory of just hold on, and I never knew what I was holding on to. Everything to manage my life in my own way and with all my intellect and with every bit of piece of that Bible that I could read, none of that took away that desire to drink. When that thought entered my mind, I had no power over that choice we were on, and I was going to drink, forgetting about everything that I had just done in within days. So anyway, I'm going to just back it up a little bit. And obviously, I'm from the South, and from a little town here in Virginia called Victoria, Virginia. It's really near the North Carolina line. And we have a very strong southern accent from that area, unlike Richmonders, and that's never left me. It's a little one stoplight town. I think the population is around 3,000, and it's got one little newspaper that prints once a week. It has a social column in it where everybody's business is aired, you know, you talk about. And in that town, I grew up in a pretty crazy alcoholic home, and I'm a budding alcoholic, so I've already got this self-centeredness about worrying about what the world thinks of me and feeling like no one loves me and I'm all out of place. So all these little other things magnified that all the more, you know. My father, you know, I grew up in a home where there was really not a lot of stability. During the years before I started school, I stayed a lot with my grandmother out on the farm, and she was the one true thing I really had in my life as a child. And she didn't drink. She went to church. She had her little weird things, you know. She was always afraid somebody was going to come break in the house at night and kill us. And that kind of went forward with me in my life. But she gave me a lot of love. And one of the first things on my resentment list when I did my first inventory involved my granny. For whatever reason, that's popping up here. And it really said something about my personality. And as you will see, when I sobered up, it was really not pretty. But I went to go stay with my granny one weekend and arrived, and Granny was like crying, and I'm like, what's wrong, Granny? And it's before I started school, so I figure best, honestly, I'm about 4 years old, before I started the kindergarten. And she's like, she has a 40-acre farm. She's renting out her cow pasture and to some man, and his cows keep getting out and getting in Granny's garden. And she's like, Mr. Pollard, I called him yesterday to come get that cow out of my garden. He's out there eating my garden. My granny was a pretty healthy woman. She was country. She liked that sweet tea and corn pudding and all the... She liked to eat, and she was mad because that cow was eating her food. And I said, well, what's his number, Granny? I mean, fire flew through me. Like, how dare you? She called you yesterday, and I don't know why you're not here yet. And I got on that phone, and I told him that very thing, that your cow is still in my granny's garden. She called you yesterday. If you don't come get that cow now, Granny and me are going to be eating bacon in the morning for breakfast. Now, I had no idea. I thought, and I can remember, just like it was yesterday, I went walking out on that porch and stood there with my hands on his hips. That man was down that dirt road in 5 minutes with a plyboard, walking that cow up in the back of his truck, and I just stood there looking at him like, you better be getting that cow. You made my granny cry. That had nothing to do with anything that I was raised around, because my home life was sheer chaos there, you know. But that fire and fight in me is something that just, when I got here, wasn't pretty. But it is also through doing inventory that, you know, God will use that to in a good way if you can become... If you're walking in the spiritual realm and have some principles in your life, those things can be a gift. So, and you'll see how that fire flew through the years of my drinking. So, but anyway, at home, I'm not going to talk a whole lot of detail about it, but it just wasn't good. You know, there was a whole lot of violence. My father was and still drinks. He was a bad alcoholic, and he was very violent with us. And And my mother, her entire life and to this day, is mentally ill. And during my childhood, she was in and out of mental hospitals even. And I became a caretaker in that home at a young age. My father, after a number of violent scenes, one night he almost killed my oldest sister, choking her to death. She actually almost passed out. And we got all over him, and it was just the most hideous thing. And I went and saw the law. I went and got a lawyer and found out my rights. I went home and let him know, if you ever lay another hand on us again, you're going to jail. And it stopped. But at the same time, my mom had these things going. You know, my mom was not well. And me being the caretaker and having this fire in me, I'm going to step up to the plate and take charge because I want to feel safe. And I also, you know, want to save my mom. I have desperately, and even to this day, I just want her to be happy, you know. I mean, all the sick ways of thinking I have power over other people's lives has diminished largely. But, I mean, I desperately wanted to help my mom. There was a time I came home on a weekend, and my mom had, she had been drinking and taking a lot of pills. She had what I would believe today just sort of a psychotic break, and she was getting violent with my sister, and I called her. I don't have a driver's license. As well as I can remember, I'm somewhere around the age 13, and I call her psychiatrist and tell her, set up for her to go to Richmond and get admitted to the mental hospital. My dad is off, I think, at work on that occasion, and I could take my baby sister and brother, give them babysitter, put her in the car, and drive her to Richmond with no driver's license, admit her in the hospital. Go back home. My dad's standing there drinking straight liquor, telling me that he's going to blow his brains out. I hide his liquor, hide his gun, go to bed, get up, go to school the next day, just like nothing's ever happened. And some of, you know, and I don't, you know, to the, I've never, I faced a lot of this because I just shoved all of this down through my life because that's, you know, who I am. I never really played this huge victim role. I never talked about my childhood because I was very concerned about what the world thought. I wanted people to think everything was normal. I had that cocoon spun all around me and never talked about what went on at home. But I describe this because I believe that it is incredibly powerful message about who I am and where I'm at today with things. So early in my childhood, I didn't think too much of alcohol. There came a time, and I remember very young on, I'm asking questions about what is this stuff you guys are drinking, and my dad, you know, tells me it's his medicine, and by this time I'm already mixing their drinks and getting their beer, and I start thinking, well, I'm going to be a doctor then if they get to have their medicine, and, you know, running the show, and you know, I wasn't big on drinking, but I found other things. I understand. Trust me, I am definitely an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, but through the years, I used other substances to manage that. I always set them down, but I never could set alcohol down, one thing after another. And main thing I used through the years to manage my desire to drink and alcoholism were the hand-rolled cigarettes. And that is something that I found as an early teenager and kind of got me through. I had the very first time I drank was one of those times when my mom was in the mental hospital. My dad was off to work, and I stepped up to be the caretaker of the house, and I'm, you know, cooking and doing laundry. And I come home from school one day and decide, well, since I'm an adult, I'm going to have a beer. So I go out and get me a Pabst Blue Ribbon out of the refrigerator in the garage, and I'm going to tell you the truth, I didn't have any kind of, this feels good, I want to do it again. I thought it tasted awful, but I drank it and I went on about my business. There was nothing like, I didn't want to repeat that again. I mean, I can tell you that, you know, the things early in my, you know, teenage years, the things I grew up with, I said, I'm never going to drink. I told people that, you know, it's like the devil. But my hand-rolled cigarettes weren't. So, The first time I drank where I had any kind of, I guess, ease and comfort, as a lot of people say, I figured I was somewhere maybe around 13 or 14 years old. I drank some of those little Miller ponies with some neighbor girls, and we had like an 8-pack of them, and I drank about half of them. And I remember getting silly and having fun. We were listening to music. But, you know, I went home that night and I slept on the top bunk. My baby sister's on the bottom. And I wake up in the morning, step down that ladder to get ready to go to school, and I step in my own vomit. And, you know, the fun of that scenario, I guess, in addition to, at that time, the things that I'm seeing at home just didn't make me want to really repeat that experience. So, the long and short is that when I was about 16 years old, a number of things happened at home, and I just said, this is it. I'm getting out of here. So I go, and by this time, I'm like cutting grass or doing whatever I can. I like to make money. I worked for a guy making guns across the street from me for years. I think folks around there knew, you know, stuff wasn't right at home, and they knew, you know, if Susan didn't mind working, and I did. So I went and talked to this neighbor lady and to let me paint a house of hers for, I don't even remember how much money, but it was enough to get out of there. So I paint this house. I actually paint some guy to get up high on the ladder because I'm scared. So I guess I learned about subcontracting real early. So I get this money, and I as I'm painting that house to come away, and one of the superintendents of the school comes to me and says, you know, you're not coming to school, that's right, and I'm not coming back either. I'm leaving town. So he, long and short, he makes arrangements for me to go and take my GED. And that was, I was too young at the time, but he made some loopholes for me to go over there at 16 years old. I went to Farmville, Virginia, and sat and took this test, never cracked a book, and got my GED when I was 16. So I go to Richmond and lie about my age and get this job. And I'm not making much money, so I decided that I want to go back to college. And during this time, I still, drinking has not really kicked in. I think maybe on one occasion during this time in Richmond, I went to a pool party, and they were serving like some kind of rum and cokes, and I don't remember leaving that place. I mean, my drinking from day one has not been normal, and I can tell you that I recognized that, and I was so afraid that I was going to be like my father, and as it turns out, I very much am, and worse, to be honest. So anyway, the long and short is I end up going for a year of college. I can't pay for it, so I joined the Army, and I had decided that I was going to be going to health care, you know, the caretaker in me. I want to save the world and, you know, make such a difference in the world. Seemed like a secure future for me, so I signed up. I enlisted in the military to become an X-ray tech. I'm going to tell you that at this point, you know, in my life, when I left home when I was 16, I'm like, these people have embarrassed the fire out of me, and I know I can do something with my life, and I'm going to do that. I'm going to show this world who I am, because I thought, you know, what I did, who, you know, how much money I made, and, you know, kind of playing God that just grew through the years was going to make up for all of this stuff that had occurred in my childhood. I'll show you who I am. I'll run the show, and, you know, I raised my mom and dad and all this stuff. So, you know, I decided in my first year in college, I'm, like, making straight A's. I'm like, you children are foolish if you think I'm going to go out here and party with you. I really want to do something with my life, and I approached my career much that way. The thing is when I'm in the military, I get stationed in Walter Reed in Washington, D.C. You couldn't ask for a better place. I got a great jump start on my career moving into one of the more specialty areas. But Walter Reed was the one that developed drug testing in this country. And this was in like 1981. And we were the first candidates to be tested. And there goes my whole game plan. So here I am, 19 years old. My whole life strategy about how I'm going to survive, be a big shot in this world, and maintain my little feel-good subtly is just wiped out. And all of a sudden, alcohol looks real good. And there's where I started. I was around 19 years old. I was at Walter Reed. At that time in the military, you could have a couple drinks during lunch legally and go back to work. Now, that I never did. I just, I always knew once I started drinking, I just didn't know what was going to happen. So if I started at lunch, I'm not coming back to work. So I already knew this, and I hadn't hardly drank, you know. So, I get in, move on up in the rank, and there's no doubt that coming from an alcoholic home, I have no idea what healthy relationships look like. So I meet this guy quickly after I met Walter Reed, and I'd seen him around a couple of times, and we meet at the NCO club one night, and we slow dance out on that dance floor half drunk, and I'm just like, oh, I'm in love. This is it. And, I take him home with me that night, and we are really in love. And next morning, I want to marry him. He never leaves. We actually physically move in together within a week, and within 8 months, we're married. And he comes from an alcoholic home, too. And so you can imagine, 6 months into that marriage, actually, during the honeymoon, I still obviously, we're not married. That relationship didn't last, and it was a disaster. And I had weird ideas about what love really was and what a healthy relationship. But I sure thought that that right house, that right man with the right house, having some babies, would bring fullness and happiness in my life. And I then no way could ever achieve that. I mean, it's, the steps here have helped me see understand some of my strange ideas about, to me, all of my relationships through the years have been higher powers. I've used them to make me feel good, and today I get that my higher power is God, the creator of the universe I call God. And so, some of those things, I haven't tested those grounds a whole lot, unfortunately, but I was one of those people that didn't need to have a relationship when I came here for quite some time. So, my marriage is on the rocks real quick, and there was never really a lot of violence or anything, but it was an awful lot of smacking things around, breaking popcorn machines, waking up in the morning, and I'm always, these are the days when I'm really as I start drinking regularly, the problems pile up regularly, so I start experiencing that sheer terror we have in the mornings after a night before. When you wake up and you know you don't remember, the last thing you remember wasn't anything like going to bed and saying good night, honey. You know you don't know what you've done. And, you wake up in the morning trying to look and see, is he mad or what is this? Or is there a mess around here? Is the car outside? That sheer terror that many of us experience. And I did nearly every time, that I drank, waking up thinking, there for those few minutes, I'll never do that again. And sometimes it might be a few days or a week, but those memories would fade the next time that thought came in my mind. It was like an obsession I had, with alcohol. Once I had that thought, we were on, and I didn't care. I had consequence after consequence. I think in my early 20s, I had my first DUI. They told me I slapped a police officer. I have no recollection of being, arrested and going to jail. I remember waking up in the Richmond City, overnight, and they had this bare mattress. And I don't know, I wake up, somehow or another, they've let me have a lighter, and I'm trying to light the mattress, and I'm like thinking, what are you doing? you can't start a fire in the city jail. I don't know what I was thinking. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that, that I would do. My marriage failed, I decided, during that marriage, there was, I don't exactly remember the event, but I remember, this is the first time I ever came to know, Susan, you're an alcoholic. I went to treatment for 30 days in Richmond. Something had happened, and I couldn't bear the thought of losing my husband, so I'm like, well, maybe I got the same thing my dad does, so maybe I'm going to go over here and go through this treatment program. So they had a 30-day treatment program, and I get in there with all of my, run the show self, and I'm going to be the president of the unit, and I bring two ladies home from there with me after my 30 days is up. My husband certainly doesn't appreciate that. One of them rolls out the hand-rolled cigarettes within a couple of days, and I'm down with that, you know. And I never picked up any more chips. I came to several AA meetings back then, and, you know, this was my perception. I never heard, you know, anybody say anything about God, and I very much believed in God. I never heard anybody say anything about you need to go through the steps. I mean, I just came in with the 22-year-old mind, still wanting to run my life myself. Looked like AA meetings were death sentences to me. You know, I just could not see being chained down here. And one of the last AA meetings I went to was a huge speaker meeting in Richmond, and a lady was speaking, and she was almost like in a catatonic, like there was no rise in her syllables during the whole thing, and she had, like, blacked out and gotten on a plane and not remembered flying to somewhere out west. And I'm thinking to myself, well, at least I hadn't done that. Although I've done things equally as ridiculous, I still compare myself out. Well, I hadn't done that. And she's like, well, I've been sober 5 years and I'm still depressed. And that's the last thing I heard. And I was like, that's it. I'm out of here. I'm going to go to church. I'm going to develop Susan's plan. You're just not going to let alcohol be a priority. You know, one of the things that further down the road, after the end of my marriage, I'm going to pick men now that don't drink, so that don't party. I'm going to pick me a godly man, and he's going to help me. So, I mean, you know, through the years, it was there were a number of things that I used for that sense of power. I'm a power seeker. And when I use anything that's on this earth, like alcohol, men, jobs, you know, who I think I am, the image I want to portray for the world, it's been a disaster, and I go after it obsessively. But when, you know, the answer for me, my power has to come from God. And here, and I never understood that. I was a faithful member of various churches and sang in the choir and was on the board, did this, that, and never could have any kind of prayer life or any sort of ear to hear anything God, you know, was saying to me until I came here, surrendered, and, you know, had that spiritual awakening. These were things I desperately sought through the years. I can quote that Bible inside out to you. I've been to Europe, followed the footsteps of St. Paul so I could be good as him. None of that ever worked, you know. So, you know, through the years, I tried to, you know, pick my relationships and do things to manage my life. Now, at this point, I'm in healthcare and have, you know, gotten out of the Army, and I moved into the private sector of healthcare, and I end up in management. I get into, you know, I'm always fascinated at the new technology that comes out with medical imaging. It's incredibly fascinating how I can put you on my scanner and tune in some radio frequency and turn on this computer and gather this energy and come up with an image of the inside of your body and see what's wrong with you. It's just incredibly fascinating. So I move up into MRI and I end up managing. I'm one of the first people that works in that modality in Richmond, so I get into my way into management. So this, by 1990, I'm managing this MRI center at this job that I was at for about 10 years, and you know, I'm really getting concerned about how the healthcare industry is behaving and how they, you know, are treating people. And it was during the time, some of this was legitimate, but the way that I acted on it was not. And it was way far out there. You know, I've always felt like I'm a take charge person, and God has appointed me to save this world and correct all these wrongs. And sometimes I used to stand, especially at the end, I get to law school and see all these other things, so devastating. I don't know exactly what God wants me to do, which problem he wants me to fix first, you know. So I start seeing, they start doing layoffs and downsizing. And, you know, during the 80s, the healthcare industry was fat. I mean, and there was a lot of robbery of insurance companies. They put you in the hospital with no concern about the cost, and they do all these ridiculous things and sort of milk the insurance industry. And so between the government and the insurance industry said, no, you're not going to do that anymore. So they cut back a lot on the reimbursements. And so the pendulum swung way to the other area, where all of a sudden my career is impacted. We don't have enough help. I'm seeing people literally die and lose limbs because there's not enough help in the hospital to take care of them. And I'm working under some little CEO at this point who looks like Opie Taylor, who's younger than me, driving a BMW and lives out in the richest section of town. He has $10,000 curtains in his house a friend of mine put in, and I'm not feeling him. And he's asking me to do things that they can make money, and I'm not feeling it. I'm feeling like a prostitute, to be honest. They're asking me to go out and do marketing, and I think, you know, I'm all about making a dollar. At this point, I'm about finished with, I had decided to go back to school. I'm going to get my MBA, and I'm going to get in there and fix Opie Taylor that way. You know, I think that free market is good in many ways if you're fair and reasonable and honest. But I have real issues as it relates to making a whole lot of money off of people's ill health. There's a lot of moral issues, and like I said, I'm not going to preach about that tonight. But at the time, I felt like, well, I need to do something about this. And so I'm sitting in this meeting with this Opie Taylor guy one day, and with other managers from the lab and radiology. We are the muscle. We are the meat. We are the capital money, bread-making, you know, the cash cow for the hospital. And so we're always, you know, being told what to do to make more money. And so on this occasion, Opie Taylor, I can't remember, I think his name was Chuck, calls us in and tells us, we need not to do MRIs or scans on patients when they're in the hospital. What we need to do is call their referring physician and tell them to reschedule it as an outpatient next week. The hospital makes a flat fee when you come in the hospital with a particular diagnosis. So they have this head them up, move them out mentality. Let's get them out here in 12 hours so we can make $4,800 off and only spend two to fix them and bring them back next week as an outpatient. If we do an MRI, we're going to get $5,000 next week. And that's just not going to fly. And I'm sitting in this room looking at him thinking, you know, I'd like to see your grandmother be in this hospital and you tell me to put her out, bring her back next week. She's had a stroke. Let's do an MRI on her next week. And something changed in my world that day, and I think it speaks. I don't believe that I would do this now because I've paid a lot of consequences. But I walked out of that meeting with this vacuum. This came into my life. That's it. I'm leaving. I'm going to law school, and I'm going to be a lawyer, and I'm going to come back and fix this industry. So that is exactly what I did. I mean, it was like, boom, I just start telling people from that point on, you know, how I'm going to come back and rock the healthcare industry and change the world. I sell every, you know, I have, at this point, I have, I'm a very functional alcoholic. I work for an alcoholic. She would call me up at night, jingling the glass, slurring speech, say, she's not going to be there. So naturally, it was okay for me to do the same thing on occasions, call in drunk. No consequences. Doesn't matter whether you have PTO. I mean, I got, you know, and when I was there, I shined. I did a good job and made a lot of money for them. So, you know, but by this time, I'm like absolutely incapable of having a relationship. I don't want much of anybody in my house. I'm very arrogant and, you know, very, very focused on doing, you know, doing the things God wants me to do to save this healthcare industry. So, I have the house, the car, the boat, and all this place on Lake Gaston. I have land on Lake Car Lake. And I sell all of that and take the LSAT and finish my bachelor's degree and go off to move to Maryland and go to law school. You know, I'm very concerned about my image and what the world thinks of me. And I'm like, when I go away, I burn some bridges in healthcare. You know, like, y'all, I'm going to come back and fix y'all. Not going to do that when I come back. You know, I'm gonna fix these problems. If you see me on television, it's going to be on CNN. It won't be on a commercial. That's what things. Those are the kind of arrogant things I announce to people, as if I'm going to come back and really do these things. So, and my drinking is pretty much nearly every day. I right up to the end, and I very much hung my hat on this pride, as delusional as that was and as sick as I was, I would still come in here early in the rooms and tell you how I didn't drink in the morning. So I You know, that's really the truth is the majority of the time I didn't, it's because I was too sick from the night before. And so, you know, but I didn't see the truth of that. You know, I'm very concerned about this image, you know, who I am, what I do, and what I'm going to do in this world. So what I'm trying to say is during that, you know, first year of law school when they literally try to kill you, I really didn't drink a lot, you know, because I was got that power off of what I'm going to do to save God's world. And funny, you know, I go up there with all these ideas about healthcare, and then I start seeing all of this racial profiling, and, oh, my God, we got to help the Mexicans, and, you know, they're not treating them right, and I'm just, like, all over the place. Tax law, we're going to do this. They shouldn't be taking everybody's home, la, la, la. You know, just, like, all over the place. After the first year of school, and I did drink some. I'd cut loose on the weekends, you know, but for whatever reason, I was never physically addicted to alcohol where I had to go through withdrawal, you know, so I could white knuckle it for a couple of days. You know, I started school for my bachelor's degree. I told someone this today in 1995, and in 2005, by 2003, I graduated from law school on the top of my class, and I don't know how I did that, because my second, third year of law school, I drank a lot, and I rescheduled my classes so that I didn't, you know, have to go in the morning, and made clients or court, you know, meetings when I was supposed to be in court. I scheduled all of that around my drinking, and I had decided I'm going to get an MBA in addition to the JD, so I move on after 2004, and in the spring of 2005, I'm three classes from finishing my MBA, and by this time, I'm really hitting it hard. I live up right in the city, inner city of Baltimore, right on this, the most expensive, elegant restaurant is right next to where I'm living over top of this travel agency, and the governor is getting let out of limousines there, and there's a gay bar on the corner here and a gay bar around the corner here, and I can go and get liquor at 3 a.m. And so I start, you know, here are the days where I'm like, you know, I poured out tons of gallons of liquor in the morning saying I'll never drink again, to finish my studies up at 11 o'clock at night and run around that corner and get tequila. I'm drinking tequila, straight tequila with lemon and salt, and I have been diagnosed with high blood pressure, extreme, acute, you know, bad hypertension, and I'm on medication that won't half bring it down. And so I get really sick. And my family, I'm whining to them on the phone, you know, end up in the hospital from an acute hypertension incident where they were like, you shouldn't be alive. You know, my numbers were so high. My bottom blood pressure number was up above 200, and they were like, you should not even be alive. And I'm like, get me out of here. My family says to me, come home. We'll take care of you. And I say, okay, you owe me anyway. I've raised you. It's about time you did something for me. So I go home, and I am an end-stage alcoholic, and within a week, I'm out partying and with people that I grew up with in Victoria, Virginia. I have three classes that I'm supposed to be finishing online. I am absolutely incapable of focusing. I dropped those last three classes and pretty much lost that entire degree because of my alcoholism. I thought I had died and gone to heaven. We were out in the lakes and the rivers and drinking it up, and my life, you know, it spirals down real quick. My parents I end up doing a little bit of hard drugs there right at the end, because alcohol, for me, you know, I would, at this point, I'm drinking straight liquor because nothing else works. And I get that I'm such a mess when I drink that I can't go out. It's not fun. It's just not cutting it. There's no warmth that comes over me when I start drinking liquor now. And so I start doing some drugs. And And I stole from my parents while I was living with them. I took checks and took money from them to get what I wanted. And they ended up giving me money to leave their home. And I am pretty much unemployable at this point. Every moral line that I thought I'd ever had, I crossed. I'm not in any way praying. I'm not in any way going to church. And these are things that even through the years, even though I'm a budding and growing alcoholic, those things were important to me, and there was no thought or anything like that. You know, I end up moving to Richmond with that money, get a place, get a job, and I end up getting fired from that job. And that was just the beginning of that end. It was on, here's where, you know, God started doing for me things I couldn't do for myself. Remember, I just went way down. I mean, I'm down in a hole in the darkest cave that I've ever been in my life. And at that job, there was a young lady who's one of us and who's been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for about 10 or 12 years. And she had come up to me when I worked there mentioning meetings. And I'm just like thinking to myself, get out of my face. And I'm not going to any AA. And I'm really, really sick, you know. And so when I get fired from this job, she calls me, and I'm ready to start coming to some meetings. And her and a friend of hers start picking me up and taking me to meetings. And, you know, I can't see anybody in these rooms that has any kind of intelligence that's going to run my life. You know, I had 1,000 things going on in my head. I was truly, and those were some of my more forefront thoughts. But underneath all of that, I was very scared. I was very lonely. I felt unloved. I didn't, you know, trust people. I just did not know what to do. I started thinking if somebody would just tell me what to do, and I knew they knew what they were talking about, I would do it because my life was out of control. I had just finished all this education. I had all this stuff. My life was just beyond reach, and I did not know what to do. I go to these meetings with them, and you know, I can't stay sober, and they eventually get sick of me. And I remember I continued to try to go to the meetings, but I continued to drink. If that thought popped in my head, I'm on. And at this point, I managed to, within 4 or 5 months of that incident, I managed to get some part-time work through. I mean, I knew a lot of people in Richmond, and a friend of mine knew I was a mess, but he hired me anyway. And, you know, I'm still drinking. Somewhere down this road, I get in this just depression where, you know, I remember I get in this 3-week period where I lay in the bed. I had a tremendous drunk, and it was a drunk that I drank for 3 days straight, and that was something I'd never done. I got up the morning after I got a bottle of liquor, and I was going to the sink to pour it out like I have to do so many times and say I'm never going to drink this again. And before I can get to the sink, I turned the bottle up, and that just led me on a 3-day binge. And somehow with that that waking up out of the reality of that and the feeling that, you know, I don't know what to do to get my life together, the only thing I could think of was suicide. And so I started planning the suicide. I'm renting a house from a friend of mine, and I'm like 3 months behind, and I decided I'm going to cut my wrist. I get the knife, and I'm going to bleed my wrist in this trash can, and I'm going to lock my cat out. I had to think it all out, you know, as crazy as I am. And I'm in there with all this stuff kind of in place, and I really didn't say, well, I'm going to roll over and do it right now, but these are things I'm getting there. I mean, it was like I wasn't. A friend of mine called who knew I was in bad shape, and she's like, well, I'm going to send you $500. And I'm like, don't bother. I'm not going to be here. Click. And that's my family nurse. My baby sister, who I felt like I raised, and in many ways I did. I helped protect her. She called me from France. She got wind of this. She lives in France. And she started hollering at me. And something about the words that came through that phone just got my attention. I can't remember all the details, but she was, one of the things she said to me was, I am not coming over there to your funeral. And I just was like, oh, you know, I was just crying. I was a mess. I was, you know, I mean, I was a hopeless drunk. I was at the bottom of a, you know, late stage alcoholic. And I started listening to what she told me to do, and she called me every day for 90 days. And one of the, she told me to go to AA meetings. She told me to go over here to this address. Our friend Susan that we grew up with lives over here, and I believe she goes to AA. So I wait and go the next day and knocking on this girl's door, and sure enough, you know, she's there. She's somebody I grew up with. Her and I start going to AA. But the long and short of that is, eventually, Susan sort of became my higher power, and she drank and caught one night and called me over. We've been going to meetings for quite some time, and I had it was like 2 weeks that I had not drank at this point. I had 2 weeks sobriety. She's like, I hate to do this, but why don't you come on over here and let's throw down? And I'm just like, I can't do it. And I had been over to this meeting in a whole lot of meetings in Richmond, and I'd heard a whole lot of fluff. I'd been to Alcoholics for Depression where they talked about their depression, and then, you know, I'd been to a lot of meetings where they talked about they were mad at what happened to them at work that day, and there were some meetings that caught my eye where they talked about God, and they talked about the big book, and they talked about the nature of our self-centeredness, and one of the main things they talked about was our emotional sobriety, and that rung a bell with me because I knew my drinking was horrendous, but aside of that, I had an extremely, you know, emotional problem that I just did not know any longer how to fix, and I was like, I want to hear that tape. And the very person I heard actually, well, so this woman named Valerie has done this workshop on emotional sobriety, and so when Susan drank, that was God moving me to move out into AA because she was the one that I clung to. I would come out of meetings, did you hear that idiot? Did you hear what they said? You know, I'm coming into meetings. I am not asking them to sponsor me. You know, they will not tell me what to do. And I'm like, oh, you know, the mess. You know, just thinking I'm like better than somebody in AA. And that was exactly how it was. But when Susan drank, it forced me to reach out. You're going to either go die with her or you're going to reach out. And so Valerie had sponsored Susan before. So I decided, well, I'm going to call Valerie and see what Valerie suggests I do about Susan drinking. So I called Valerie, and I can tell you, you know, I had all these wear and wins. My life is a mess. The place I lived in, the health department would have condemned it. And somehow or another, I reached through this mess in my bedroom and picked this one wear and win out that Valerie has put her number in like some months ago. I remember she's like, call me. I'm like, yeah, right. And so I call her up and I'm telling her about Susan drinking, and what do? You know, Susan's drinking and she's a bad alcoholic. I don't know what to do. She said, well, there's nothing you can do till she's done. But what about you, Susan? When are you going to get a sponsor? And I was like, you know, I didn't call you to talk about all of that. Well, I called you to talk about her. I told her I didn't want anybody telling me what to do, and I can't remember what she shot back at me, but it was just like that, you know, drill sergeant, and something in me just collapsed. I said, okay, well, maybe you can help me then. So we made an appointment, and I went and met with her. One of the first things she said, well, I need to make sure you know you're an alcoholic. And I leaned over to her and I said, I peed in my pants. I drank. Like that was the only qualifying factor for her. But don't you tell anybody. If you could look at me, I couldn't even believe she was asking me that. You know, don't you see? I'm a mess, you know. So, what time do you want me to finish up about? 5:02, something like that. Okay. You know, God's never seen fit for me to talk about a lot of sobriety, I guess. You know, I'm going to tell you that, as I described in the beginning, I absolutely know with all of my intellect and all of my heart and soul that we have a higher power that created us and put us here on this earth. And there are energies or things here that are of good, positive, and negative. And I believe God is good and about good things. And I believe that, you know, coming in here and doing these steps in, you know, just a heartfelt way has enabled me to have the real relationship with that God of my understanding that I have always sought. I have worked very hard here, diligently and quite painfully with the ego that I've had, to develop an ongoing and deeper relationship with God. It was 2 weeks into that sponsorship with Valerie that I called her, or it, for the first time I'd ever called anybody that I wanted to drink. And she, and it was everything I could do with my pride and my ego to just admit to anybody, I think I want to drink. She's like, well, I think you better go to a meeting. I was like, okay, click. I didn't appreciate talking to her too much. It's early days. She scared me. She was like the Wizard of Oz. And, you know, talking to me was like talking through a black hole. You would say hello, and you don't know what would come out on the other side in my mind. And that's the way, you know, Valerie's very straightforward. And I went to that meeting, and it was in a few weeks I realized my desire to drink was gone. I mean, I remember jumping up and down, I had prayed for God to do that for me because I had heard it in these rooms that that desire was lifted at varying stages for people in these rooms. Life has a grand journey. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best. And, you know, I truly believe, I'm a big book person. I believe that God divinely inspired the words in these books to show us things that we couldn't figure out ourselves here on this earth. God uses other folks to speak to us and to write to us. And I have no doubt that much like, and I, you know, believe, that personally believe the Bible was divinely inspired, I believe the same lies here. And each time I read this, new things pop out to me, just like that thing on page 29. Well, I'm 5.5 years sober. Of course, already I still think I know everything, but there are things in there that I don't reach out for me at first. You know, I went through these steps just like laid out in this book. I did that inventory with the four columns where I primarily focused about the truth about me and got set free. And quit blaming the world. Quit thinking that God had appointed me all this power to save his world. I can accept people where they are on their journey. My judgment on this and different things have died down and faded in me. I am not any perfect spiritual giant standing up here, but I am completely committed and teachable in some respects. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only way that I know, and the way that God has lined it out in this book for us to get free, to recreate your life. You know, if you're that hopeless alcoholic like me, you must have a solution that is ongoing and gives you an outline for an action in the spiritual realm. And I can't. If you ask me what I do, I would quit my job, go travel to Europe and be drinking with Greek fellows tonight. That's what my idea of what I should be doing, and going over there and pursuing Mother Teresa's journey, you know, and ended up drinking that night. But it works. And you're talking to one who tried absolutely everything. I didn't get into that in detail, but I, with my heart and soul, I stand up here and tell you tonight that it, you know, this is, you know, this is the way. It's only that spiritual awakening, a relationship with your higher power. It unlocks some sort of goodness and some sort of power in you that comes from our divine creator. It's always great to be here, and this is a great group. I love all you guys. It's good to see you, Randy, too, and Lynn, and meet you and everyone. And thank you so much for asking me to speak tonight. Yeah.